All right, welcome, welcome. We got a really good crowd this afternoon, so I'm excited. I wasn't sure the last workshop of the conference here. Really thankful to have everybody showing up, sticking around, and showing some interest in forest management. So, yeah, I think we could probably get going here. I'll make my one final mention of the propaganda at the table over here. If you are interested in taking any of the handouts that I'm going to reference throughout the presentation today, they're available over there, and I'll leave them out after the presentation as well. Yeah, I guess just starting it off too, I'm going to try to kind of personalize some of the examples in here around a family woodlot that I've got to just kind of illustrate some of the points that I'm talking about. I think this type of presentation benefits from interaction with you guys and just trying to meet your interests. So if you've got questions, I encourage you to bring those up at any time. I'm going to be asking for a I'm going to be asking for audience participation in a couple instances. Just looking for trying to elucidate some of those examples, and then I'm also going to be asking for folks to write something down at two different parts in this presentation. So if you got a pen, I encourage you to have that ready, a piece of paper. I saw some napkins up here. I can pass those around. I think some of the best notes are taken on napkins. So, and if not, you can always make a note in your phone, but just kind of a couple points up front. Yes. Okay. Sounds good. Yeah, it is a little warm in here. All right, yeah, so I thanked everybody for attending, but I also want to give a big thanks to Marble Seed for inviting me to talk today. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to all of you, and this is my first Marble Seed Organic Farming Conference. It's really been a great couple of days, meeting some really fantastic people doing really interesting work. So yeah, I hope to stay engaged with this community and yeah, just keep up the good work. So to start off, I'll just kind of read the summary of today's session so that we all got kind of the same expectations as we jump in here. So farm woods have the potential to add economic, environmental, and social value to your agricultural operation, and this workshop is going to provide an overview of the planning, the people, and the programs that can help your woods reach their potential. So we're going to touch on a couple of the economic opportunities, tax considerations, conservation priorities, and lifestyle benefits that are found in the farm woods. So that's kind of my goal today. Like I said, I've got a presentation here that we're going to kind of walk through, but at any time, feel free to jump in, ask your questions, and we can take this wherever it needs to go today. So my name is Tony Johnson. I am an Extension Forestry Outreach Specialist with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Extension. My home office is in Fond du Lac County, and I've got a statewide responsibility. There are three forestry educators for the Division of Extension that cover the state of Wisconsin. I've got a background in farming and working with the USDA, and one of the audiences that we identified early on in my employment with UW-Madison was the farmer woodland owner audience as a group that we have not been effectively reaching with our outreach. So that's kind of the genesis of what brought me here today. And yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about finding value in your woods and some of the ways to reach that potential. Clicker. Yeah, I can just go from here. All right, so again, today's agenda, we're going to start off with some top tips, give you kind of the information that I want to get out up front, and then from there we'll just briefly touch on a couple income opportunities within woodlands, and then get into some of the planning, people, and programs that can help make those opportunities a reality. All right. So, top tips. Number one, recognize the value of your woodlot. So we're going to talk a little bit about this up front. You know, values can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. I think, you know, historically people think income generation from woods, and they're thinking about timber sales, timber harvest, selling the actual trees on their land. We're going to talk a little bit about timber harvest today, briefly touch on that. We're going to talk about some agroforestry opportunities. And then I'm also going to touch on some of the other values that woodlands bring, both recreational, as in viewing wildlife, or maybe hunting with your family, and as well as some of the conservation benefits that woodlands can bring to soil and soil conservation and water quality. So the next three are kind of a bundle, which is getting into our planning piece of the presentation today. So it's about taking an inventory, writing a plan, and working with professionals where it's needed. You know, forestry is a very, it's an art and a science. So, you know, you can read a forestry textbook and it's not going to necessarily tell you what to do with a given piece of land, and just relying on the expertise of people who have a lot of experience in the field is highly recommended. The next top tip is about understanding forestry practices. We're not going to get into forestry practices today, but I think that's one of the big take-home messages for the farmer woodland owner, is that, you know, given the equipment and the skills that you have, there's a lot of forestry management practices that you can, you know, do yourself, right? So there, if you understand kind of what the steps are to achieve your forestry goals, you've got the tools, equipment, and know-how to get some of that stuff done. So that's a really important thing up front too, is just understanding what foresters mean when they talk about specific practices. Next one is learning about local markets, and that's going to take time and often rely on professional assistance as well. So I get calls all the time from people who are asking me about the value of certain stumpage, certain species, and it's impossible to answer that question over the phone. It's all related to you know, your very local markets. Where are loggers selling their trees? What types of mills do you have in your area? What kind of wood do they accept? And, you know, do you have enough value in your woodlot to justify getting a logger out there to do the work in the first place? So there's a lot around local markets that is, you know, just highly context specific and location dependent. Last one is just take advantage of resources. So we're going to outline some of the resources that are available for landowners, thinking about some of the people that can offer technical assistance, and then we'll talk about some of the programs as well. All right, so thank you all. I appreciate your attendance today. It was a really good conversation, and no, just kidding. We're going to jump into the rest of the presentation here, and we'll start by talking about timber harvest. But first, before we jump into that, I'm curious, in the audience here, who owns woods or has some type of a management say in woodlands? All right, right, so pretty much everybody here. And where are your woods located? So how many people have woodlands in Wisconsin? All right, vast majority. How about Minnesota and Iowa? All right, well, yep, no worries. We're just going to move the back wall and get a little more comfortable in here. Yeah, so I apologize. Some of the resources that I provide today are going to be a little Wisconsin specific, but there are analogous people and programs in Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, and others, and neighboring states. So just briefly touching on timber harvest, so I handed out this publication, which is kind of the landowner's guide to timber harvest. It gives you six tips for executing a timber harvest on your property, and that's all I'm going to say about that. But really the important thing about timber harvest is that it's going to be one of the most consequential land management decisions you make on your property. If you're managing, you know, a 40 or 120 acres of woods, you know, in your lifetime, you may only conduct one or two timber harvests, right? So you don't have a lot of opportunity to learn from past mistakes, and, you know, you're making decisions that are going to impact future generations with the value that's left on that land. So I think this is, timber harvests are something to be really careful about when you're entering into the process, and it's just really important to have professional involvement. We're going to talk more about the foresters, who are kind of your key advocate as a landowner to get the value from your woods and from your timber harvest. And then we'll talk about a little bit about the loggers who are doing the work and kind of some other considerations there. Folks in the audience, has anybody had a timber harvest on their property? Is anybody willing to share like a one sentence or two sentence thing that they learned in that process? Maybe they weren't expecting beforehand. One thing I hear all the time is just that a timber harvest is a very dramatic change to the landscape. You're gonna have, you know, a mature forest that's going to be basically, well, depending on the type of harvest, it's going to be look dramatically different. Yeah.
I had an unwanted timber clearing on my city property that took down every mature tree because it was right between the lot line. So instead of my shade forest where my monkshood and my Solomon seal and the trillium came up, they cleared everything on each side of my lot. I lost every mature tree, and there's no privacy, and there's nowhere for my birds to hide. Everything that I had in the shade. It was really traumatic.
Yeah, that sounds like a very negative.
I could start crying now just thinking about what it did to my yard and to my ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. And so was that like a right-of-way situation?
Situation. New owners of the building adjacent to me, and they wanted a new fence, so they took the old fence down, and they took their foot, and it included everything I had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, yep, that's a really, really good point, is that not all timber harvests are created equal. They're, depending on the type of forest that you have, the forest ecosystem that it is, there's going to be kind of a historic disturbance pattern that forest was reliant on to achieve its mature point in succession. And yeah, so there's opportunities, everything from draft horses to fully mechanized, you know, operations. Any other experiences with timber harvest in the room? Yeah, go ahead. Yep, exactly. And popple is another, you know, system where you're going in and clear cutting, but it's got that really fast regeneration time, and it is a forest ecosystem that was reliant on that kind of high disturbance pattern. So in order to, you know, regenerate, it needs that disturbance. So it's, yeah, depending on the type of woods that you have, they're going to respond very differently to the management practices that you employ there. And we can talk more about timber harvest when we get into the forester and logger discussion, but I just wanted to kind of put that at the top of everybody's mind as kind of, you know, the biggest income generation opportunity. And there's challenges with managing for timber harvest just because it takes such a long duration to potentially get to where you need to be before you harvest. And there's, you know, wind events or fires or unforeseen circumstances that can, you know, change your plan. So it's really complicated and, yeah, just something to be aware of up top. All right, so the other kind of broad category of income opportunities I want to talk about is agroforestry. And I think, you know, in this room, I think most folks have a pretty good idea or have a feeling for what agroforestry is and what that means. But when I work with foresters, there's a lot of confusion about what agroforestry is, how it works on the landscape. And I think there's good reason for that, because there hasn't been a great explanation of kind of what agroforestry is as it relates to foresters. In my, the way that I define agroforestry is I just think about it as the intentional integration of trees into whole farm planning, right? But really, as the USDA defines it, it's two linear practices and three farm management systems, right? So it's not necessarily, you know, just managing your woods in a specific way. But yeah, I think, you know, when I talk with foresters a lot of times, this is kind of the assumption that we get is that we're allowing cattle into the woods so that we can get reduced tax rates potentially, or, you know, that shade in the summertime. And, you know, a big part of my work right now in trying to get farmer or get foresters to buy into some of these agroforestry practices and bring in some of the silviculture and their expertise with managing individual tree species is kind of thinking outside of the standard forestry practice handbook that the DNR silviculturists use, because the trees in agroforestry systems don't fit into the traditional silvicultural model, and it's difficult to kind of navigate that distance between the forester's expectation of when I go into a forest, I have to prescribe the best management practices that are in the silviculture handbook, but it's not maybe not necessarily meeting the needs of the landowner. So yeah, I just wanted to put this in as well, just because there is, I think, some confusion, particularly in the forestry world, about how foresters can benefit farmers who are interested in working in these types of systems. So I mentioned it's kind of agroforestry, as I think about it, and the USDA defines it as basically two linear systems, so forested riparian buffers, where you're putting trees along wetland areas, so that transition zone between land and water to provide that constant root cover and kind of follow your soil health principles around water quality and preventing erosion. And then you've also got alley cropping, which is, you know, it's an agricultural system where you're incorporating tree crops into that row cropping system. And in my mind, a lot of times when we're thinking about alley cropping systems and some of the species that could potentially be put in there, it's almost more horticultural than forestry related, right? So you talk to a traditional forester about alley cropping, and they're not going to necessarily have the background to give you good answers on, you know, what trees to use. So yeah, the bottom left here, we've got a chestnut raspberry alley cropping system. And then windbreak is another one of the linear practices. Alley cropping is a farming system. Silvopasture is a farming system, right? Because it could be any number of different species that are integrated into this kind of system. Windbreaks are a linear practice where you're basically just, you know, putting perennial trees and shrubs into a line to prevent wind erosion. But yeah, I'm curious, is anybody in the room practicing what they would consider agroforestry? All right, can we just get a couple examples of specific practices?
So I don't own my own woodlands, but I have a farmer friend who has 300 acres, and I select within his forest for mushroom logs.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so that's the practice we'll be covering in the next slide, forest farming. Yep, so that's good. Any other agroforestry? And what species are you
using? That's why I'm here, because we've got to fill it this year.
Okay. Yeah, because that's one thing that I've been thinking a lot about is just, you know, how do we diversify the products that we've got and use some of these practices, particularly windbreaks and riparian buffers in these, you know, primarily conservation practices. How do we add crops to those locations? So I got hazelnuts up in the upper right. University of Wisconsin is doing a lot of work there with the Hazelnut Collaborative. And then riparian buffers, yeah, thinking a lot about, you know, different elderberry or other crops that could go in those systems as well. Anybody doing silvopasture?
I'm planning one right now, but I don't have the land yet, but I'm working on it.
Okay, what kind of, I'm curious about tree species and animal species. So what do we got for trees and animals? Mm-hmm. Okay.
I'm thinking white oak, persimmon, mulberry, maybe a couple others, and pigs.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We've got no animals, but we're hoping for an edible food forest, kind of permaculture. culture thing, maybe currants. She was thinking chestnuts, all edible tree species and bush species.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, so in my mind, when I think about silvopasture, I'm thinking about, you know, mimicking savanna ecosystems, right? And in the upper Midwest, our foresters do not have a lot of experience with managing savanna forest ecosystems. So, you know, if we're thinking about like a oak species and you want a mass crop in there, the DNR foresters and consulting foresters in general are going to have pretty good silvicultural knowledge about how to propagate and grow those native species. But when we're talking about tree fruit, like they don't have any idea how to, you know, grow apple trees in most cases. So I think that's just another thing to keep in mind when we're talking with our foresters about our agroforestry interests, is just kind of where do they fit into the system. And most of the time it's, you know, kind of on those native tree species and thinking about the silvicultures and then also the markets that are associated with those tree species. Yeah, so I don't know. That's kind of my big takeaway on agroforestry, is just thinking about it specifically as we can about practices. And when we have conversations with foresters, just knowing that there is going to be skepticism most of the time when you go to a forester and ask them or tell them that you want to be involved in agroforestry practices. But I think when you get down to the nuts and bolts of what's actually happening on the farmstead, it just makes sense, right, to include trees in, you know, the places that they should be on your farm. And there are opportunities to work with foresters on that. So forest farming, in my mind, this is kind of the agroforestry practice that aligns most with what a forester is going to be able to help you with. Foresters are, you know, trained to know, to manage the health and long-term viability of forest stands. And as I was mentioning before, and you all know, it's a long-term endeavor managing a woodlot. You've got, you know, decades between, you know, management actions potentially, and then multiple age classes. So, yeah, I think this is probably the practice that makes the most sense to engage foresters in if you're at all interested in getting some of these non-timber forest products out of your woodlot. I mean, is anybody in here? We had a mushroom farmer. Anybody else doing what they would consider forest farming? Yep. Yeah, I think that's kind of the obvious one in a lot of, you know, woodlands in the upper Midwest. But yeah, I think the big thing about forest farming in general is that it's a lot of work, right? It's a labor of love. You all know this as organic farmers, kind of the way that you have to love what you do. And I think, you know, engaging in some of these different opportunities within the forest farming practice, you know, they can align with what you're doing in other parts of your operation, or just be, you know, a respite from time weeding your vegetable garden. You know, there's a lot of different ways to look at how we can incorporate pieces of their individual agroforestry practices into our overall operation. Let's see. So kind of the other big things that I wanted to touch on just around woodland financials are how important it is to have an accurate land assessment. So there's a couple different classifications of forest land within Wisconsin, and it's going to be the same for other states. So whether your forest is a productive forest taxed at a recreational level, or whether it's potentially adjacent to a woodland and getting that farm woods tax rate, is going to make a major difference in your end of the year tax bill and kind of understanding how your land is assessed. And having that relationship with a local assessor is going to be really important, and making sure you have that right up front. Like, you know, if you've got a recreational forest that you use for non-timber forest products, you can get a use value tax assessment in that woods and get your tax burden dramatically reduced. I know that's commonly done for maple syrup producers. If you have a certain number of taps and the equipment to harvest maple syrup and maybe some sales receipts, you can qualify for that land use classification assessment change. So, you know, we probably all got your tax bills, right? A couple month ago. And yeah, so just being on top of that. Generally, the reassessment time, if you've got a question about your land use assessment and you want to get it reassessed, is in January. Let's see. So tax programs. In Wisconsin, we've got the Managed Forest Law Program, which is the most widespread forest incentive program in the state. And it's basically a tax incentive for landowners who get a forest management plan and agree to do sound forest management. So that could include doing a timber harvest. It could include invasive species control. Basically, the agreement is that you will manage your forest to the silvicultural guidelines so that you can produce forest products. And the DNR will change the way that they tax that land and give you a reduced rate. So instead of having a recreational rate, you would have this managed forest law rate. So historically, this was called the Forest Crop Law Program. And in the 1980s, it switched to the Managed Forest Law Program. And the rates are always changing. And it's kind of a bit of a political football. But it's a really popular program with landowners and a great way to reduce your tax burden while, you know, having that management plan and trying to achieve your other goals. I'm not going to talk about these last two that much, but leasing is obviously an opportunity for landowners. Leasing maple trees for tapping is one area. Leasing for hunting is another opportunity. And then carbon markets. I wanted to just touch on this. Has anybody been hearing news about forest carbon programs in their area? Has anybody been approached about enrolling their land in a forest carbon program? Okay, so this is, I think the whole carbon market space is really growing quite a bit, and there are some emerging opportunities for woodland owners to enroll in carbon markets. I would just say right now, be very skeptical of any offers and programs, and it's kind of the Wild West as far as how landowners are getting reached out to around getting into these programs. And some of the, there's a lot of contractual issues with some of these markets, including if you sign into one program, you may be ineligible from ever enrolling that land in another carbon market in the future. So there's, I don't work with many landowners who are currently enrolled in these programs. There's small pilots that are taking place in northern Wisconsin and then in other parts of the country. But just wanted to raise that as another income opportunity that folks may see in the future. But just at this point, I would recommend being skeptical. And then kind of what I was hoping to focus more on today was the non-economic values that people have with their woods. So when I first started with Extension, I went around the state and did interviews with farmer woodland owners, kind of asking about, you know, how they manage their woods, what kind of information they access, what their reasons are for managing their woods. And just time and time again, found the real advocates of conservation that I talked to, they all had some kind of intergenerational connection with their land. And very often it was, you know, kind of this non-economic land, the woods or the wildflowers or the hunting opportunities they had with their parents. And I think that is a value that we can provide to the next generation that should not be discounted. And when we're thinking about, you know, what does that land bring to this operation and, you know, your family in general. And then, of course, there's, you know, a bunch of other opportunities just for personal use and gathering and enjoying wildlife and doing those kinds of things. And then the last kind of piece that I wanted to touch on in the values is just the potential or the opportunities that you can find in forests for conserving soil and improving water quality. I know here in Wisconsin, there's a lot of effort amongst farming and producing groups to improve soil health, improve water quality, and, you know, part of my message is just trying to extend those ethics beyond the field edge. Think about the soil health principles that you apply in the field to the forest as well. If you walk in your woods and there is bare ground and you see erosion going into a waterway, you know, that should be a red flag, just like if you see some erosion happening in a farm field. And, you know, I think the nuts and bolts of this is following the best management practices for water quality when doing forestry activities, and then thinking about kind of the soil health principles that I mentioned before, and just extending that into the woods. All right, so we outlined some of the values, and then I want to transition this into kind of taking, you know, your thoughts, which maybe there's something you identified in the prior slides that you have going on your land and you're interested in. My goal today is kind of taking those ideas into goals and thinking about how we can take our goals and turn them into actual activities that we can do on the land. So I'm going to try to talk through a couple goals and the planning process, and then leave here with some specific actions that you guys can take to, you know, move forward with your forest management. So I think the big thing, again, just step one to a farm forestry plan is determining your goals and interests, thinking through some of those values that we went through, whether they're economic, social, or conservation values, and thinking specifically about your woods and what you get out of them. So, you know, when we're thinking about if hunting is an important value, thinking about specifically what types of animals you want to hunt, how you want to hunt them, you know, thinking about recreation opportunities or income. Just in this stage, step one, trying to take kind of general ideas and make them as specific as possible just so that they're actionable. And so this is a picture, 1938 aerial image of my family farm. It's only 11 acres in Sheboygan County. 1938 was the year of the first statewide flyovers in Wisconsin. So the Wisconsin Geological History Survey has a database statewide of all these photos, and you can click on them and find them on a map, and it's a pretty interesting reference. I've got a picture of the land in upcoming years, and it kind of follows a very similar picture or outline where you got the woods on the left, you got the farm field on the south there, and then actually the whole right-hand side of that section was a non-metallic mine, so it's a mining pit now. And then, you know, just thinking about some of my personal values, I mean, number one, it's for family. So this is my wife's family's land, so they were very prolific farmers in that area, and through a couple of generations have basically sold off everything except for this. And it was a woodlot that had some sentimental importance to my father-in-law, who just recently passed away. So just thinking about kind of the historical change from, you know, 1938 and where that woods was, you know, still in my family, and now where it is today, and thinking about that moving forward. I've got two young kids at home, so just getting them involved and out there and connected to the woods is just one of my number one priorities. Wildlife is really important to me, as you see in point three. Hunting is really important too, but just trying to diversify what is out there, both plants and animals. We are right now in maple season. Has anybody got taps and trees out there? All right, so we got a couple. So yeah, it hasn't been running this week, but last weekend I was able to make a gallon of syrup off that land and do some pancakes and French toast with the kids. And we do firewood, and there's a really good population of wild ramps in there as well. And then I wrote mental health is kind of my last value on there, because I find a lot of joy in running a chainsaw and just having that opportunity to go out and work in the woods. And I think it's a different type of work than, you know, maybe I get to take part in otherwise. So yeah, that just kind of outlining some of my values, and as I'm thinking about, you know, putting together plans for this land. So for the folks in the room, you know, what do you like about your land, and how do you use it? And I'd ask you to, you know, maybe write down one thing that you like particularly about your land. Is it hunting? Is it camping? Is it, I don't know, harvesting mushrooms? Just think about one specific thing that you like about your land, and then we'll kind of build off of that value that you've identified. And then as we're thinking about these goals, I think it's really important up front to also think about the limitations that we're all under. So whether it's financial, physical, the time you have, the distance to your land, or just, you know, life events that happen, we're not going to be able to make all of our dreams a reality, right? So we're going to have to pick and choose what goals are really important and what, you know, what we want to work on. And, you know, it's obviously all a balancing act. And then obviously your property is going to have some limitations for you as well. You know, whether you've got land that's even big enough to manage economically, or, you know, the past land use management and how it's kind of yielded what you've got today. There's going to be definitely some limitations on where you can go with your land based on what's there right now. And I think to just refer folks to a forester, when you're thinking about those land limitations, forester is really a great person to help kind of put two and two together, because you know your land better than anybody, and they have that silvicultural experience to be able to see, you know, forests and know what it could look like in a decade or two given certain management actions. All right, so the next step is we've got our basic idea of what our goal is, and then we want to be able to turn those goals into very specific activities so that we can get them on the calendar and actually get them done. So here for my property, I like to improve the turkey habitat. We've got a lot of turkey in the area, but no turkeys that roost in our woods, and that's something that I'd like to change. So thinking about what are the individual stand activities that I can do to help promote turkeys on the property. It's about putting together time-specific work with measurable results. So we've got a plan put together to plant some pine trees and oak trees in a 3-acre field next to my woodland. So that's kind of the level of specificity that we're looking for. So it's knowing what, if it's a particular species you want more of or a particular thing you want to harvest, having that down to the species level and knowing how it relates to the woodland to really target in on that activity. So kind of thinking back to your goal and thinking about some of the potential activities, maybe you don't know much about forestry, but are there things that you might be thinking about doing? Are there any, does anybody want to volunteer and say what their goal is for their land and maybe an activity that they're planning on doing to achieve it?
I'm sorry for the recording. We should have it.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm on 10 acres. Was a farm in northeastern Wisconsin, 80 acres once upon a time, and I got 10 acres off the front. So there were no trees when I bought the property 40 years ago, and now I got about 3 acres back in trees of spruce and pine and cedars and hardwoods and oaks and walnuts and mixes or whatever that are now, you know, 20, 30, 40 feet tall or whatever. But thinking about northeastern Wisconsin, it was like 90% forest when this country was settled. Today, where I live, it's 80% ag land. And so eventually, I'd like to turn my little 10-acre spot back into the native forest that was there when this country was settled and get those species back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great goal. And then thinking about the specific actions to make that happen, you've got tree planting and then all of those kind of successional steps to lead back to a mature forest. And thinking about, you know, some of the old growth that may have existed in northern Wisconsin, that's something that, right, that's a goal that we're not going to be able to achieve in our lifetimes. But we can, you know, with the right activities, put the steps in motion to be working towards that outcome. So for my property, I'm thinking a lot about forest health and regeneration of tree species. So looking at the top left picture there is a deer exclosure. We've got a very high deer population in that area. There's a lot of ag land and a golf course nearby that's really good bedding habitat. And deer are going to be a major force in the long-term health of this forest. And as you can see on the upper right there, there's not a lot of small trees or regrowth. And the other thing to point out in that upper right picture is garlic mustard, right? So you've got invasive species, you've got native species like deer, you've got earthworms, which are invasive species in woodlands in the upper Midwest. So we've got kind of these three big factors that are impacting my understory, right? So I've got an open understory without a lot of young trees, so I'm worried about 20 or 30 years from now when I have a big wind event and I don't have those young trees to fill in my canopy. But the question is, like, how do I go from this? How do you manage the deer, the earthworms, and the invasive species? And right, so it's just really complicated. And we put together a plan for our woods with a forester to kind of do deer exclosure, do some invasive species removal, and then do some premature opening of the canopy to do some crop tree release. But that's kind of one of the other points from today is just the complexity of the forest ecosystem makes it really difficult to match activities to your goals oftentimes, because the outcomes are coming so much later than the activities that you're doing, and they're just very complex and dynamic ecosystems, which leads into the next piece of this is maybe you've got some goals and some potential activities, but there's going to be some expertise that will help you to make those activities happen. So the next thing to think about with your goals to activities is, you know, what questions do you have? We're going to transition the talk now into some of the, well, we'll wrap up the planning piece and then talk about some of the people and programs, but the forester is the most important person as far as consulting for the long-term sustainability of your woods. So, you know, if you've got questions for them, I'll talk about some of the free forestry resources that can help answer those questions. But if you've got, you know, specific goals and specific questions for foresters, you're going to really streamline those conversations. So yeah, the step two, we just went through step one as far as outlining your goals, and step two is finding a forester for guidance, right? So it's possible to create your own management plan, but it's recommended to work with a forester to do that. Service foresters in the DNR will work with private landowners free of charge to help put together stewardship plans. I'll talk more about that. But silviculture is an art and science of producing and caring for a forest, and it takes an education and experience, right? So there's lots of people who can work on their own car, but you know, how many of those people are gonna replace their whole transmission in their driveway, right? So there's certain activities that I think we can all be comfortable in doing, but then maybe some of the bigger pieces like writing the initial plan and putting together the timber sale might be things to rely on a professional for. So if you've got a forester, the first thing they're gonna do and something you can be thinking about ahead of time is just taking stock of your forest conditions. You know, just knowing how you use your woods spatially and throughout the year will help give the forester the information they need to kind of think through some of the composition, structure, age, and health questions that they would have. So foresters will, when they conduct inventories, they're going to be looking at all these things in addition to the understory composition and then assessing the feasibility of that site based on the soil that's there. Right, and a lot of times the current vegetation is going to be a real reflection of the past management there, so that's going to be a good clue. So taking notes of that early on can help kind of put together a piece of the map going forward. So next step is determining the activities that are needed. So these are going to be the specific things that are outlined in your forest management plan. After the inventory, the forester is going to basically divide the woods into stands based on the types of woods, and then they'll give you a list of suggested activities that are each going to have a timeline, and these plans could cover anywhere from 10 to 50 years. Yep, go ahead.
So, I haven't heard you talk much about the effects that climate change is going to have on the structure of our woods. Are there foresters out there, and are they being trained on how to kind of help, like, kind of figure out what we're going to be dealing with? You know, the climate prediction models say we're going to have a climate of Arkansas. We need to start planting trees that are native to Arkansas. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the question was about climate change and working with foresters around, you know, maybe assisted migration or working with tree species that are going to be suited to our climate in the future. And yeah, they are, the DNR is doing a lot of active research right now and moving species, transplanting, and doing nursery experimentation to see feasibility of tree species. So it's definitely come into the conversation. I think as, you know, landowners, you know, being advocates of the species that you want to see on your land in the future, and kind of looking south is, you know, makes a lot of sense. But yeah, foresters are definitely thinking about that in terms of, you know, the current state of the forest right now. And the, I think the biggest impacts that we're going to see from climate change in our woods are going to be the impacts that we see from invasive species. So it's going to be like emerald ash borer, or kind of those changing climatic conditions that are going to allow some of these fungal pathogens like oak wilt to maybe be a little bit more, proliferate a little bit more, or allow these insect carriers to, you know, survive in our climate a little bit better. And I think that's going to be the biggest change we're going to see. And then over the long term, I think we're going to see, you know, kind of the viability ranges change over time. And I think, you know, the work that I've seen done is really, you know, species by species. There's NIACS, the Northern Institute of Applied Climate Science. I believe they've got a worksheet now that's got, kind of goes through the threats and opportunities for individual forest species moving forward. So I think, yeah, that's a really, really important consideration. And yeah, as we're talking about 10 to 50 to 100 years in the future, something that we should be putting into our planning. So just back to my personal example, we've got the woods here. We had a forester come out, so I called my DNR service forester. Every county in Wisconsin has a private land service forester who provides free property walkthroughs and advice to Wisconsin woodland owners. So I called that person from Sheboygan County, invited them out to the property, did a walkthrough, explained what my goals for the land were and our family's goals, and then we kind of just took stock of that with the current conditions. They divided the woods into three different stands, and then each of those stands has its own management practices. So some of the activities that were identified in my plan to meet my goals for wildlife, forest health, diversity, and good times in the outdoors were trail maintenance, invasive species management, salvage harvest, and tree planting. So the top two, trail maintenance and invasive species control, are going to be on any forest management plan. And those are just two activities that, you know, even if you don't have a forest management plan, it's a good thing to have a plan around those two pieces in particular. What's your trail map look like through your woods? Do you have ways to get in there with equipment if you need to? Or do you have, you know, ways for your family to access it in the ways that they want to use that property? I think that's really critical, and just, you know, an ongoing thing that you're going to have to continue to work with. And then invasive species control, I just wanted to put a plug in for the Field Guide to Terrestrial Invasive Plants in Wisconsin. It is a little booklet. It's over a decade old. They just updated it, though, with some of the new species. A really, really good guide on managing invasive species. Each species has some pictures. And then it goes through the identification, the ecological threats, and then the control methods. And then it also has this really handy guide in the back that's a calendar for mowing. And so basically it'll tell you when time of the year is to mow certain species in order to reduce their seed production. So yeah, just wanted to point people to that and just know that invasive species, particularly in small woodlots, are going to be an ongoing issue. And we can talk about invasive species later on, too, if people have specific issues that they're trying to work with. I know that's something that a lot of landowners are interested in. Yeah, go ahead. So the question was about the species that are in the three stands. So stand one, so this is Sheboygan County. It's right on Lake Michigan. And so the eastern maple, beech, hardwood forest kind of extends along Lake Michigan, and that's what that stand is. So there's red oak and, really, really cool beech trees, sugar maple that we tap, red maple, and some box elder, and then a couple of white pines. The number two is a kind of a, it's the hill slope, so it's it's like a old brome field, basically, that was the gravel pit when they did the non-metallic mining there. So it's kind of a steep slope with no soil and just some perennial grasses there. And then three is a wetland that is filled in with Phragmites, right? So we've got some issues and a lot of opportunities to improve this property. So we've got, like, with the stand two, where there, it's the old gravel pit, we're doing planting in there. So we're selecting for native species that are drought tolerant. So we're thinking about potentially white pine, white oak, bur oak. And, you know, those are really great wildlife species too. And then in the wetlands, it's primarily about invasive species control. And then in site one, our hardwood, a really nice hardwood stand, we're doing the salvage harvest in 2023. So last summer, we had an epic windstorm come through and knock down just a tremendous amount of our red oak and cherry trees that were in there. So we've got what they call a salvage or a sanitation harvest to go in and remove what we can. I'm not planning on taking out all of it. I think that's one of the mistakes that can be made on a small woodlot is trying to keep it too clean, right, which is not good for the ecology or the wildlife, soil ecology or the wildlife. So we're going to be doing a lot of brush piles for habitat. We're going to be doing some firewood collection for maple syrup processing. But yeah, and then the tree planting, the big part of that is preparation this year, so killing off that vegetation that's there and making a good planting bed. So that's kind of, that's what I'm working with, and we were able to. So I teach, I do forestry outreach, and, you know, every time I walk in the woods, I still gain a lot from foresters. I think, you know, just their experience on the ground and the, you know, their ability to kind of project what those activities will look like in the future is just really, really helpful. So I, thanks to our relationship with the forester, we've got our list of practices for the next 10 years. And what they call a stewardship plan, and that stewardship plan also qualifies us for cost share assistance through the DNR or NRCS, and that's something we'll talk about too. But yeah, the first part of this is just, you know, I'm trying to advocate for planning, right, and just thinking about woodlands in terms of your whole farm operation, and you know, maybe it's not the dollars and cents that is gonna, you know, provide a living, but it's an important part of lifestyle on the farm. So once we've got all of, you know, the kind of nuts and bolts information, it's important to keep records, put this stuff on paper, and, you know, keep that organized for people in the future. Yeah, go ahead. They're publicly accessible. Yeah, it's the University of Wisconsin. I think it's the Geological History Extension. Yeah, so if you just Google 1938 aerial images, it'll take you to a UW-Madison website, and then they've got a state like map, and then there are little red dots all over that correspond with the original aerial images. So yeah, you should be able to find that, and I can pull up a link to afterwards and show you, but... yeah, it's publicly available and pretty easy to navigate. Yes, yeah, sorry, statewide. You know, it hasn't been done with that kind of frequency. You know, now there's a bunch of different satellite images. So this was just the initial first ever flyover with planes in 1938 where they did a statewide coverage. So yeah, I don't know. With that database, they don't have like other years that you can flip through. It's just basically the current satellite image, and then you can toggle it back and forth with the 1938. I like to go to Google Earth, and you can just click on the time scroller on the top, and you can go back in time to past satellite photos for like the last, I don't know, 20 years or so on Google Earth. So. Yeah, there's a couple different resources for doing the mapping stuff, but yeah, I always like to point out that 1938 image because the landscape has changed a lot since then, but not so much in that farm. All right, so next piece is the people. So I've talked a lot about working with foresters. The big point up front is that in Wisconsin, you'll kind of run across three or, Wisconsin or the upper Midwest, you'll come across three different kinds of foresters. So you've got the DNR, private lands foresters, who are in every single county in the state, and their job is basically to assist private woodland owners, answer questions via phone, do property walkthroughs, that kind of stuff. There's private consulting foresters who are like an agronomist. Consulting foresters, you know, they have all different ways that they're paid as far as like how they like to do business, whether it's by like, you know, the time that they spent or the specific job that they're doing. We'll talk more about that. And then the third type is industrial foresters who work for like a mill, and they will go out and help to procure supplies for that mill. So they'll work oftentimes with private consulting foresters that a landowner would have, and it'd be kind of a forester to forester connection for sales in those instances. There's less and less industrial foresters operating in Wisconsin with kind of the downturn in some of the mills and the forest processing in the state. So you don't see too many of them, but they're out there. So this is the website for finding foresters in Wisconsin specifically. It's the Forestry Assistance Locator. And what you do is you go to the website, put the county that your land is in, and then you can select from the forester types on the bottom there. So industrial foresters are not included in this list because they don't advertise their services to the public. They're working for a private company and going out working that way. The service forester, like I said, is that general forestry assistance and advice. The tax law forester is the person who administers the managed forest law program. So it's a specific forester that works with landowners in that program to make sure that they're following their forestry management plan. And so if you're in MF, is anybody in here in the managed forest law program? So we got one. Okay, and yeah, and basically the situation there is that once you're in that program, then you just have an additional forester to help you navigate that, because MFL is either 25 or 50-year contracts, so it's a long-term commitment. And then the last bullet there, the cooperating forester list, is the list of private sector consultants that it's a list that is maintained by the DNR, and they're a group of private foresters who have signed an agreement with the DNR to practice sound forestry, follow a code of ethics, and basically be included on this list. So we'll talk a little bit more about each of these, but I think, you know, if you remember Forestry Assistance Locator, you can Google that with the DNR and it'll take you to this website. So each forester or each county has a service forester, a tax law forester, and then the cooperating foresters often operate on a bigger geographic area depending on if they work for a big company or how much work they have. So the DNR foresters, again, free property walkthroughs, advice and resources. They can help prepare single purpose written plans for cost sharing. So that's, you know, you want to do something like a tree planting and they can help you write a tree planting plan that can qualify for some of the cost share money that's available through the state or through the DNR. For smaller, simpler properties like my property, that 11 acre, they can actually write a comprehensive stewardship plan that will kind of cover all aspects of your operation. But they oftentimes won't be able to do that for larger woodland owners, and they'll refer folks to the private foresters to write those plans. And then I think the big point here too is that they're available for a consultation throughout the year and anytime you have questions. So you get a logger knocking on your door. He says, "Hey, we're operating in the area. I noticed you got some really nice trees." And you're like, "Oh, I don't know what I should do." You can call your DNR service forester and, you know, just kind of run it by them. And just another sounding board for any kind of advice you're getting, whether it's in the private marketplace or NGOs. So the consulting forester, this is, again, is that paid relationship like you'd have with an agronomist who's helping you to really specifically hone in on some of these forest-specific pieces. So I think the biggest things that they will help you with are the access to local markets for wood products, knowing who's buying what types of products. So if you've got a woodlot that has, you know, multiple species and multiple age classes of timber, you could potentially have a sale that is going to, you know, four or five different buyers. And your consulting forester is going to be the person that can help negotiate getting the right products to the right buyers and making sure that that is all happening in a way that follows local mill specifications, right? Yeah, I've seen a lot of people, or I've seen a fair amount of people lose a lot of money just by, you know, not following those specs that the local mills are buying on, maybe cutting their logs a couple inches too short because they don't know about, you know, the processing equipment that the mill is using. So those types of things are really, you know, kind of where the consulting forester will shine. They've got obviously knowledge of the silvicultural systems, and then they, you know, having worked with loggers, they understand, you know, as was mentioned before, loggers can have all different scales of equipment and ways that they operate, and just having somebody who's very familiar with what, you know, a logging system is going to do to your land and how it's going to look, and whether that's going to fit with your goals as a landowner is really critical. And I think the big thing too, you know, if you like forestry, you're interested in managing your forest, you feel like you got a pretty good handle on it, I would advocate, you know, if you're going to just work with a forester one time, it would be on the sale administration. So working through the timber sale process, like I'm keep reiterating that timber sale really is the biggest action that you're going to take in your woods, you know, potentially in your lifetime. So doing that right is really important, and a consulting forester is going to be critical in making that happen in a way that you can profit from. So they'll help to prepare the contract and negotiate that. There's a lot of different ways that timber is sold. It can be sold, you know, delivered to the mill. It can be sold on the stump. It can be sold, you know, weighted on site. There's just a lot of nuances in how loggers and mills operate, and then the trucking piece as well. So they'll help put that all together with you. They can help you solicit bids, and then they'll help, obviously, with the contract compliance. Marking your timber sale, making sure that the loggers are following through the way that the sale is marked. They'll advertise it, collect bids. Oftentimes, foresters will use a sealed bid process where you put out the notice of the sale, and then people, the individual loggers, will write their bids in a sealed envelope. You'll have a date that you'll collect those all by. Your forester will take all of those, and then they'll open the bids all at the same time and then select the winner, and that's often a way that landowners can get a little bit better price on their timber. And then they act as your agent. I guess the last thing on this is, if you're thinking about a timber sale, the way that I generally break down the value for people is a third is going to go to your logger, and whoever, a third of, you know, the money that comes from all those trees is going to go to the logger and who's ever cutting the trees. Another third is going to go to the trucker and who's ever hauling those trees to the mill. And then the last third is for the landowner. And generally the consulting forester's piece comes out of that landowner third. But in all the studies that I've seen and analysis of sales, landowners are still coming out ahead with having that forester involved and taking out a piece of their third by capturing more of that value throughout the sales process. So yeah, it can be enticing if you get somebody knocking on your door with a, you know, a bag full of money and saying, "Hey, we want to cut your trees." I just think, yeah, in the long run, you're going to get more value if you work with a professional. And yeah, any questions on timber sales or working with a forester on timber sales? All right. So a couple things to look for when you're selecting a forester is, you know, it's like the same things you would look for in a plumber, right? Do you have, like, personal recommendations? Do you, is it somebody that you can actually communicate with and they understand what you're trying to work for? Do they have, you know, certifications or educational experience? And then I think the last piece is really important, too, when working with a forester over the long term, is just having somebody whose philosophy matches yours so that they can advocate for you with, you know, some of the bigger activities, and then also, you know, just know where you're coming from as far as working through some of the management planning. So the scope, when you're thinking about a forester, first thing you got to look for is the orange vest, right? They all wear a vest. So if they come walking around your woods and they don't have the big forester's vest, that should be a red flag. The next thing is the scope. You want to make sure that they got the equipment that they need to get the job done. And timing is a big one in the forestry world. There's a kind of a lack of trained professionals in the space in Wisconsin right now, so it can be hard to get people in to do the forestry work on a timely basis, so just understanding whether that person's going to be able to meet your timeline. Again, checking references, asking for insurance, and then the costing is kind of it's a little nuanced. So like I mentioned before, foresters will charge for their services in a lot of different ways. So when you're asking and starting to establish this relationship with a forester, don't be afraid to ask about, you know, their cost structure and how they do it up front, because they're going to see different models. And depending on how actively you want to manage your forest, how actively you want to engage with your forester, you got to align their business model with, you know, something that you're comfortable with and fits your pocketbook too. So that's, yeah, just I think first conversation, you should have a question about cost structure with anybody that you're considering. So I mentioned this before, the cooperating foresters. I think if you ask private foresters in the state of Wisconsin, they will say the cooperating foresters list on the DNR Forestry Assistance Locator is the most unbiased source for qualified foresters in the state. And I think these are all consulting foresters who, like I said, have agreed to that code of ethics and the silvicultural guidelines. They do annual training with the DNR, and they've got this ongoing relationship with the DNR. So if, you know, they've got maybe unhappy customers or bad business practices, that relationship with the DNR is not going to last, and they will no longer be a part of that list. So in Wisconsin, just know consulting foresters have the opportunity to get onto this cooperators list, and the cooperators are a great group to pick from if you're trying to build a relationship with a forester. So working with a logger is kind of the same stuff. You know, you're looking for training, education, experience, references, proof of insurance. I think the best thing to do is to talk with landowners who have worked with that person in the past on practices that are similar to the ones that you want. You know, they might be a great aspen clear-cut team, but they're not going to be able to come in and do that uneven age management in your maple woods. So, yeah, talking with landowners who have had similar work done is really important. And then, you know, just being upfront too with your forester about your expectations about how a logger is going to operate too. So loggers also have some certifications that you can look for as a landowner. These are kind of the professional organizations that demonstrate a commitment to the industry and ethical standards. So you can look for the Master Logger Certification, the FISTA, SFI, or Great Lakes Timber Producer Association seals, and they'll often advertise that if they're associated with these groups. And then again, just back to this point of making sure that experience that they got is specific to your situation, the equipment that they're going to use fits your woods. So again, it's the same thing, talking to references and making sure that they have insurance. So this is really important that they've got the insurance to cover the entire term of the contract, because lumber contracts could take place over, you know, several years. Maybe conditions aren't right one year. Maybe they don't have workforce in the area. Oftentimes they'll sign contracts where they'll say, I'll get this practice done within the next, you know, 3 years or so. So just making sure that they've got that insurance coverage for the entire time, and then if they're working with subcontractors as well. All right, so some of the final resources I'm going to touch on are so we'll do a little DNR, it'll be Wisconsin specific, and then we'll talk about the NRCS. So I mentioned the Forestry Assistance Locator and those kind of two types of foresters that you can find there, or the three that are there. The DNR's cost share program is the WIFL GAP program, Wisconsin Forest Landowner Grant Program. It's very similar to the NRCS's EQIP program, where they're doing cost share for, you know, discrete contracts. So it's like, write a forest management plan, do invasive species removal, do a tree planting. There's going to be basically an application to the state of Wisconsin through your DNR service forester to apply for this program. And it's very similar to EQIP. It's got a little bit lower cost share percentage, but the administration of the program is easier for landowners. So there's less trips to the FSA office to sign paperwork, and the timeline is the same every year. So you know when you apply, they're making all of their funding decisions at a quarterly basis. So it's not quite as sporadic as the NRCS programs. And then the other big thing the DNR does is they've got a whole nursery system where they do tree sales. So there are several nurseries throughout the state, and they offer sales to Wisconsin landowners for conservation and reforestation purposes. The thing about them is it's really high quantity, so they're selling hundreds and hundreds of seedlings for really low cost. They got into this space because there really wasn't that need being met in the private marketplace. There's a lot of larger trees that landowners can find at nurseries, but this small stock wasn't available, so that's kind of their niche. So yeah, if you're doing like planting whole fields with hundreds of trees per acre, this is a really good route. Otherwise, counties in Wisconsin, and I imagine other places too, often have tree sales where you can get smaller quantities of trees at the local county level. So NRCS, we got a three-step process. So number one, who here has worked with the NRCS on projects? Okay. All right, so a few. I like to advocate for the NRCS as technical assistance in addition to financial assistance, and I think just having those relationships and knowing that that's another person that you can talk to and they are talking with other landowners who may be having separate issues, I think it's an important relationship to make even if you're not interested in applying for cost share. So step one is connecting with the district conservationists. And then any kind of financial assistance, whether it's the WIFL gap program through the DNR or the NRCS's programs, you're going to need a forest management plan to qualify for those. So private lands foresters in Wisconsin can help write simple stewardship plans. Otherwise, the process to get a forest management plan is working with a consulting forester on where they'll charge you basically to write a forest management plan that meets the specifications for the program people at the NRCS or at the DNR. The nice thing is, though, you can apply for the WIFL gap program in the state, or you can apply for EQIP through the NRCS to get a forest management plan written. So you sign an application that says, I'm interested in writing a forest management plan. There's going to be a lot more funding for this kind of thing in the next year with the Inflation Reduction Act. So you'll be seeing a lot of EQIP practices, CSP practices funded that maybe historically weren't. But one of those types of practices is going to be management plans, and basically what they'll do is, depending on the size of your forest, they will write a contract that says you get, it's a formula that's supposed to be a cost share, but most of the consulting foresters know what the NRCS pays landowners for forest management plans, so it often works out where foresters will charge what the NRCS pays for a management plan. It just kind of works out that way where, the NRCS looks at it as maybe a 70% or 90% cost share. But with, it really isn't taking anything out of the pocket of the landowners to meet the things that they need in their management plan. WIFL gap also has a similar, like I mentioned, to EQIP, a similar program where they'll fund the forest management plans to be written that qualifies you for additional plans, whether that's crop tree release or invasive species management or that kind of thing. And then step three is financial assistance, right? So that's actually taking that management plan to enroll in some of these programs. So EQIP, CSP, CRP are kind of the big ones that pertain to forestry. So again, NRCS, I'm an advocate of their technical assistance, right? So every district conservationist that you meet might not be a forestry expert, but they have local experts in their service area. So Wisconsin's divided into four areas, and they've got area resource specialists, and then we've also got a state forester here who, in Wisconsin, well, every NRCS state has a state forester who can provide technical assistance. And I don't think the NRCS gets enough forestry work, so I'm just out there trying to bump up the amount of funding that they provide to support forest landowners, because I think a lot of people just, you know, assume going into the FSA office is about what's happening in the crop fields, but there are these opportunities to take advantage of some of the programs for your land. So EQIP, CSP, CRP are kind of the three big ones. EQIP is financial assistance primarily. There's like 200 conservation practices that are funded through this. You got to check with your local office. Like I mentioned, some of the common practices are invasive species control and timber stand improvement. So that's basically you apply for a specific practice and either that practice gets funded or not. If it gets funded, you take that money after it's awarded and you go and get the job done, and then you go back and tell them that, tell the NRCS that you completed the practice, and then they sign off on the paperwork and the contract is complete, and that's the end of it. So it's basically how long you're in a relationship with the NRCS as long as that contract is in place, and it depends on the practice that you choose. CSP, this is something that I'd like to encourage landowners to really think about. So CSP is kind of the good stewardship program through the USDA. So EQIP, the idea of that is you've got a problem on your farm and you need to fix it. I've got erosion, I've got invasive species, we're gonna apply for funding to fix that specific problem. Okay, problem's gone, contract's over. CSP, on the other hand, is basically, my understanding is it arose because landowners were like, well, you're paying for all these people who are, you know, doing not so great practices. How do you reward people who are already doing the conservation practices that you're advocating? So they put together a conservation stewardship program, which basically they do a whole farm assessment, make sure that there's no erosion, wetland degradation, and then the when you're applying for the program, then you select a enhancement bundle. So it's a series of practices that are a little bit above and beyond what you're doing to try new things. It's kind of the carrot to get people to try something that they haven't experimented with, and then you get money for experimenting with those trials, and then you also get a five-year contract with annual payments. So I think the five-year annual payments with this program is a really, really sweet setup for landowners to take advantage of. It, there are ways to work the formulas to get a pretty handsome yearly paycheck by, staying consistent with your management practices and then thinking about, some type of a enhancement bundle, some type of a, that could already be part of your plan, but it's just incorporating that practice within the contract schedule. So this is, it's an intensive program, 5 years, you're going to definitely form a relationship with the district conservationists and the folks down at the FSA office, but yeah, I just really encourage folks to consider it if they're at all interested. So yeah, you got to check at least two of these. So you got to follow a management plan, make improvements to the wood or to the woodlands. This green certification is something along the lines of like the Wisconsin Tree Farm System, or else you can get another certification through the Forest Stewardship Council. And then again, there's got to be no erosion there, and then an adequately stocked forest. So I already touched on these a little bit, but these are kind of the Wisconsin-specific programs. There's the tax program, MFL, and then the kind of EQIP analogous practice program, WIFL GAP. So to qualify for WIFL GAP, you need 10 to 500 acres of forested land. As you may have noticed, I only had 10 acres of land, and some of it was marsh and a gravel pit, and so I shouldn't qualify for this, right? But part of the plan was a tree planting plan. So I have 6 acres of woods, and I'm planning for 4 acres of tree planting, so I meet that 10-acre threshold, even though it's not currently planted, so that I can qualify for these types of plans. So you can be creative here as well. And again, the reimbursement is about 50% of the cost of practices, so it's a little bit lower than the NRCS standard, but the administrative burden is less. And they've got the priority practices that they fund first, which are getting that plan written, and then the other things you see here. All right, so if you are interested in the Wiffle Gap program, the applications are submitted to the DNR service forester from your county. So again, get the phone number from the DNR forestry assistance locator, call that person, let them know you're a landowner in their county and you're interested in working with them. And they're gonna be that person that's gonna basically help you write the application, then they submit it and coordinate it with you. So yeah, again, this is a little bit more consistent application process and awarding than you'll see with NRCS. So yeah, just reach out to the DNR service forester. Okay, so we're getting close to the end. I wanted to just drop these in, just a couple other ideas about things to consider. So I mentioned the county tree sales. If you're looking at doing smaller quantities, go to your county. A lot of times it'll be the land conservation department who's doing those sales. Usually you do your orders in the winter. A lot of times it's like October, the DNR and county conservation offices open up for orders, and then they'll deliver them in the spring. And then oftentimes counties or DNR service offices will have tree planters too. So like a planter that will sit on the back of a three-point hitch where you'll actually have somebody sitting back and it's got a splitter, and then you're dropping the seedlings in as you drive along with the tractor. So, you know, if you're doing hundreds of trees, it can make sense to coordinate that piece. Local invasive species group. So there's invasive species consortiums that operate around the state, and they're often at like a multi-county level. But I've noticed lately more and more of these groups are offering financial assistance and even sending workers to do, they'll have like work crews that will do invasive species control. So in Sheboygan County, there's the Southeastern Wisconsin Invasive Species Consortium, and every year they have grants for landowners where they will, you basically apply and say what you're gonna do, and they'll award up to $2,000 to pay for some of the supplies or your time, or else they're actually working on a project right now to do Phragmites control. So they have crews that they're sending around to private landowners' land. You basically apply, say that you've got permission to manage this invasive species on my land, and then they're, you know, bringing crews in to do that work as well. So I think looking at your invasive species local groups, it's a really good resource. My Wisconsin Woods is from the Eldo Leopold Foundation. We partner with them on a lot of kind of broad outreach, social media type campaigns. And they're really good, they have a good newsletter, and they offer events. I think next week is actually Leopold Week at the Aldo Leopold Foundation, and they'll be bringing in authors from, I can't remember who's all on the agenda, but it's pretty impressive slate of speakers next week. So yeah, I'd encourage you to check out Aldo Leopold Foundation and My Wisconsin Woods. My Land Plan is from the American Forest Foundation, and it's a pretty cool online tool where you can type in your location and a little bit of information about your land, and it'll actually walk you through some of the planning pieces. So if you're, you know, maybe reach out to your forester and they can't get to you right now, or you want to do a little bit of, you know, education on your own, this is My Land Plan is a really good place to look. Wisconsin Woodland Owners Association is the kind of peer organization that operates with chapters throughout Wisconsin. Just a great place to connect with other woodland owners in your area. They do field days, local chapter events, and every winter they do forestry conferences around the state. So I just helped host one in Oshkosh area. And so I would just point you to it's called WOWA, or the Wisconsin Woodland Owners Association, for some of those events. Tree Farm System is another organization to consider getting involved with. It's kind of a landowner recognition program for woodland owners who are doing sustainable forest management. You get the tree farm sign on your property, and then there's I can't remember if it's SCI or SCF. There's a forest certification that comes with that program. So if you're in it, when you go to the mill, you're actually selling certified lumber, which can achieve better prices in some situations. And then other extension programs. I think Minnesota's got really great forestry extension program. Iowa State's just got one extension forester, Billy Beck, down there, but he does really great work with farmers thinking about managing their woods for water quality. And then nonprofits, just encourage you to connect with the groups that align with your interests. And I know the Savannah Institute was here this year, and we're doing a bunch of work with them on trialing some agroforestry practices on farms and that kind of stuff. So, go ahead. Yeah, so the DNR service forester is the person to go for that. So every DNR service forester maintains a list for their county of active timber buyers. So they'll be able to provide that. And so private buyers will just submit their name and their coverage area to the foresters to maintain. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, that's a really good point. So WOWA, Wisconsin Woodland Owners Association, is a peer-to-peer group of, you know, really dedicated forest managers. They've got the experience working with loggers in your area, and it is, again, a kind of regionally organized group. So, yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, so you've got woods, you've got goals, you've got resources. Now, what's the next step? I'm thinking, you know, hopefully for some of you that haven't made the connection with your local service forester, reaching out to that person and just, you know, saying hello and maybe inviting them out for a property walkthrough. I think that's a really actionable takeaway from this talk that can, you know, lead to a lot of different opportunities. Anybody else want to share maybe some next steps or things they're thinking about? I bet you there's experience in the room for, yeah, go ahead in the back.
The local DNR forester in your area is a really good person to just walk through free, you know, kind of situation. And then asking them, you know, what type of ideas they have for projects and just, you know, maybe just sharing that you're open to, like, you know, conservation projects or, you know, something in the area that they're trying to push or improve is like kind of eye-opening to some of that group of people, and they're like, wow, somebody actually like cares about doing some sort of project. And it's just like a great way to connect into some of the programs that you might be able to, you know, do in your woods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think, you know, in addition, I mentioned, you know, just getting to know your district conservationist, because every year, you know, within the Farm Bill, there's different initiatives that get rolled out, you know, for funding allocation, and there's priority funding, and having that relationship with the district conservationist, if they know you've got woods and you're thinking about something, maybe you haven't submitted an application because the forestry practices in your area haven't been getting funded that much in past years, they would know that we're getting a bunch of money in to fund practices. Now's the time to come in and actually, you know, put the application in and move for that now. So yeah, I'd really advocate just, you know, getting to know those people. Go ahead.
Sorry. It's for the recording. Sweet.
Quick question. Rewinding all the way towards the beginning, you were talking about taxes and stuff. So if you have some forest land, it's currently as recreational. But if you start doing wild harvests, like we're looking at the ramps, and we're thinking about improving some area to get more ramp production, watercress, and mushroom, does that kick it into a different tax category?
Yeah, so that's pretty tricky. I think the issue you're going to be dealing with is your local assessor. There isn't, as far as I've seen, use valuation for some of the niche products that don't have, you know, really established marketplaces. So, assessors are familiar with use valuation for maple woods, and they've got it in their, like, for woods that are used for harvesting maple syrup, and like they go out into the woods and they're looking for maple trees per acre that are tappable, so they've got to be a specific size, and then they're looking for the number of taps that you've actually got on your acreage. They're looking for equipment to handle the sap and either receipts for sap or equipment to process it. So they've got a list of all of this like infrastructure as well as like land kind of features that they're looking for. And I think it would probably be difficult to persuade them without receipts, you know, from some of the products that you're getting that, you know, use valuation on your woods. Yeah, I don't know specifically about what the value has to be in order to gain that consideration, that use value classification. So I think it would be something to right now just like document everything that you're doing as far as like business focus, and then collecting receipts if you're doing sales, and then making the case to your assessor that it is, you know, farm woods basically, agricultural woods would be my advice. But yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, or right, you know, the other thing is if you've got an agricultural field that is adjacent to a woodlot, that woodlot then becomes a ag woodlot just because it's adjacent to a farm field that you own, and that dramatically reduces the tax rate from recreational to ag use. No, that's not pastured woods.
So just to add to that, have you looked at the managed forest law tax, the tax benefit for the managed forest law, you know, like open category and closed, is amazing. I mean, like, you could save $10,000 a year in taxes just going into the managed forest law.
I mean, yeah.
If saving money on taxes is your goal, that way was significantly easier than trying to talk my assessor into the fact that I am doing ag practices in my woods. Even if I was, they were like completely uninterested in losing that tax roll. Like it was like against their thinking to try to save you money. It just was like not even feasible.
Yeah, right. Most of the assessors too are, you know, they're hired to come in by the county, and they're, you know, they're looking for that tax base. The MFL program is a really good one for landowners to get into, but the activities that you're doing cannot be against the DNR's sustainable forest management guidelines. So, like, you cannot graze any kind of livestock in a MFL woods. And there's been kind of a more accepting kind of view of maple syrup recently. But yeah, so it depends. With some of this understory, you know, plant gathering or mushroom stuff, it doesn't seem like that would impact the sustainability of the forest moving forward. But that's also, you know, a conversation to have with your tax law forester. Hey, Dan.
So on that note, I just got my forest management, NRCS-funded forest management plan done after like 2 years, and made a mistake hiring one of my buddies, who is one of his first plans that he was doing. He's a good forester, but I mean, really, like reviewing everything, it's so just focused on timber board feet for the most part. You know, and I was able to incorporate in invasive removal and some pollinator and tree plantings. But this thing I just want to bring up of grazing, or even just browsing goats in there for secondary brush control, I'm still confused as what is NRCS's, you know, because I say, well, I want to bring animals in. No, you absolutely can't do that. What about goats?
Yeah.
Well, maybe you can do goats. Well, what's the what's the clarification of the standard and, you know, the ability to get the approval to do that? And, you know, when I talked to my county agent, because I got Reed Canary on one side of this woods, it's low-lying silver maple, which I'm not going to go bring cattle in there when it's soft ground and tear everything up. But how am I going to control that Reed Canary? I mean, I think just planting some, some moisture-tolerant trees there is probably the best thing to do. But the lack of innovation within some of these of these forest management plans. Just for goats, what's the what is the standard? Any information there?
No, I don't. As far as the how the NRCS looks at it, I mean, it's really interesting conversation because the DNR is starting to use goats on public lands, right, and do management on their own properties. And they're also, they've got a grazing program on certain wild lands where they're working with operators to bring cattle in. So, yeah, there is inconsistency. I think, my takeaway would be if you want to be able to do that kind of stuff, don't get in the MFL program, right? And get a forest management plan to qualify for the practices that make sense to you if you want to continue cost share. If you're in an MFL program and it calls for a timber harvest, like, it's got to get done, basically, unless the site conditions change, right? So if you don't want to be told to, keep the cows out or not do a timber harvest, then, it's probably not the program. But, I don't have good guidance. And I think part of what I'm trying to do, talking about agroforestry, is I'm trying to bring foresters into the conversations that we're having in places like this and thinking about how to use trees in ways that make sense. And, maybe it's not the kind of old German model of forestry, but it's if it works for landowners and works for, the ecology of the land that we're on, I think it's something that we got.
Quick side note for forestry and NRCS is three side notes. One is tubing systems. We've been pushing them to have tubing systems as an equipped practice. They have the engineering specs, they've got the payment rates, it's all there. It's just pulling trigger making it happen. Maybe that'll happen. Second thing with EQIP is the radio collars for goats or something. That's in the works. The thing that is out there, though, even just maple syrup, is the EQIP energy efficiency for maple syrup evaporators. If you have an on-prem energy assessment, and I'll be curious, I've got an application in now, but just a couple side notes that connect in and how do you get more resources to support the work in the woods.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. All right, yeah. So that's our time. We kind of, talked a lot about planning and some of the people, and, I'd love to maybe come back next year and talk more about the specific practices. And, my vision for this is thinking about ways that we can incorporate, different practices that make sense and trying to bundle, things that work together. And I think, there's just a place on the farm for some wood. So let's do the best we can with it. So thank you all.